Awesome. Welcome back to the second hour of the Pork and Pale Ale radio show. This is Neil. Nate's off this week, and I have a real good friend, Reno Bo, sitting in this week just for a hang. That was album off his new track, Lessons from Shooting Star. That was How Do You Do? And then the one we played before that was, what was the initial track?
There Sweetheart
Deal. Yeah, Sweetheart Deal. Yeah, great guitar in that one, man.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, that was really, really good.
Thank you.
Off the air, we're just talking about the dynamics of bands, man. That's always interesting because you can always tell in interviews and how just everybody fits in those roles. And, you know, I think that's you've seen it with like Bon Jovi and U2 and, of course, the Stones and a lot of those people, yeah. Just finding that dynamic, you know. Are you going to be going out solo when you're supporting this? Or are you going to be, loading up a band?
I'm going to have a band with me.
So yeah.
I don't like to do the solo thing too much, you know.
Yeah.
I can, but I like to have the power of a band behind me, the drums and the guitars being loud. It's part of my thing. I like it.
Yeah.
So, there's usually kind of one or two guys in the band who kind of run it, tend to be, like Mick and Keith are the guys that drive that train.
Yeah.
And then I'm sure, you know, I don't know how it works, but the other guys are either have the roles or just turn up and get paid. I have no idea, but partners, I don't know. But you gotta have one or two guys who just like know what they're doing and steer the ship.
Yeah.
And make it happen.
Well, being in the beer business is something I relate to a good bit of talking to folks like yourself, you know, it's about the nuts and bolts behind the scenes, because I'm in a very, very unique, special place in Nashville, is to have a great job with great folks, and also this time and place in Nashville of having zero musical talent in any given direction. It makes me happy because I never feel like there's that underlying pretense. You feel like I'm going to hit you with, hey, Reno, you want to go jam or you want to go write sometime? Or, right. Hey, man, I hear you're looking for a bass player. I mean, dude, I've been practicing, you know. I'm just like, no, I'm never going to be that guy.
Right.
So, and then you look at, you know, the band dynamics, you know, that comes back around full circle for that is just like the business part of it. It's like, it's the music business. And I mean, this city is paved and littered with people that were great with the music part but did not collect the business part. And to that same regard, there's a handful of people out there that played the game and the business well that you're like, everybody's like, God, that guy's awful. He's got a great sound guy because he sounds like crap. You're like, I don't care. He's already clicked off 15 million albums. What are you going to say about him?
Yeah.
You know, that's always my defense.
Hey, man, that's a success.
Yeah. I mean, that's always my defense of Nickelback and Creed. You can say what you want. Limp Bizkit is still selling out, you know, 2,000-3,000 seat venues that, yeah, I know a lot of people playing in Nashville wish they could get a tenth of that to show up at their shows.
Right, man.
You know,
it's, I know,
up or down, either way. I mean, that's an interesting thing for band dynamics, is to find that happy place where, you know, they're still out playing and they're happy with their arrangement, you know?
That's why, I mean, I always got on people but I always thought it was weird that people would say, like, well, like for the Stones, for example, like,
yeah,
they're 70 years old, they should just hang it up. I mean, if you're a musician, don't just hang it up. It's like telling a guy who builds a house, you shouldn't be building houses anymore. You're 60 years old. Why are you doing that? Because that's all you know how to do, and you're good at it, and you love doing it. So why should you stop?
Yeah.
Because our perception is a 70-year-old shouldn't be on stage dancing around like Mick Jagger. I guess, you know, I saw them recently. They were awesome. They're still powerful, and they do their thing, so.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to go to that show. I would like to catch one of this tour. I've never seen the Stones before. But, you know, with that one, too, I would like to have seen it. And I don't know. My biggest issue I have with going to shows anymore, and it is literally an issue, is I really can't deal with the other dumbasses there. Because, like, when I go to a show, like, if it's a show I really want to see, man, I mean, you're like me. We have a lot of really good friends. We get tickets to stuff, and, you know, I turn down a lot because I don't want to be the guy that's not 100% into the show.
Yeah.
It's there because, you know, I heard an interview with Mellencamp once, and I've heard a lot of stories about him being a jerk behind the scenes, too. But into his defense, he always, you know, one of his quotes was just like, man, you have to think about it, you know. He goes, it was different when it was just me solo, but now that I have a family and kids and stuff, I can't just step out and do something on my own. I have to plan ahead. So when people are planning to come to my shows, he goes, I take into account, yeah, we sold them a ticket for $50 a piece. He said, but majority of those people, you know, that are my crowd now, they have to get a babysitter. They got a hotel. They went out to dinner. You know, at the end of the day, for the most part, they're probably in an average of $500 to $1,000 to come and see me. Why would I not be particular about it? Or why would you not be hardcore about, you know, making sure they had a good experience?
Yeah.
And that's what me, when I go to a show and there's that person that has their phone up the whole damn show in front of me, or the people behind me that want to chat about their walk this morning in the park or whatever, that don't want to be there. I'm like, dude, there's well-lit exits in this facility for you to get your ass out of here. And for me, I've actually had to say a couple times, I had to say things to people because I was at a, of all shows, it was a Blake Shelton show. I went with a friend that we got tickets to at the Ryman. But the Ryman, the worst show you see at the Ryman is still a phenomenal show. Yeah. You know, you're not going to go see Gallagher there. They're very particular about who they book there. But even the show there, I'd gotten free tickets, but I could tell, I assumed I was in a section with other people got free tickets. There was just 2-3 girls there just the whole time. And after about they talked to the opener and they got about the third song into his set. And I finally looked over and I said, I'm sorry, I feel like I got to ask, are y'all going to talk through this whole damn show? I'm just wondering, because if so, then me and a few other people around here, we're probably just going to move somewhere else, you know, and then it got really, really awkward. But I'm like, it didn't bother me because you could tell there's like 10 other people around me that like, thank God, I was gonna have to be that guy. And I'm like, I'll be there for you, man. Don't worry about it. Don't get me wrong, I'm not going to pick a fight with anybody over it. But it's just the experience of going to see a show that, I mean, how was your experience? I mean, the Stones, everybody had to have wanted to be there for the most part, yeah. You would think.
It was great in every way. Like, the crowd was super cool. I mean, the band was amazing. The venue was great. No complaints.
Yeah.
It was cool.
That's really good. Where were y'all?
There was one guy from Knoxville behind me who was very vocal about being from Knoxville. And he was, yeah, woo, and constantly yelling. I was like, I looked back at one point, I'm like, you know, can you bring it down a little bit? But he was having a good time. It was cool.
Yeah. I went and saw Alison Krauss in Union Station once in Chicago, and I got set right in front of the I Love You, Alison guy. Just decided to yell it out 10 times during the, and like, dude, she commented on the first time, can we just leave that one alone? Can we just leave it there? Just walk away, man.
Right.
You were there. You
got the
you
attention. Had, yeah. She said something to you.
Yeah. It's like after you travel across the country and go see a show or something, you know, I'm like, this is good. Chicago theater. That would be really cool to see, you know, Alison Krauss and Union Station. And they crushed it. It was great, but it's still always that asterisk that I can't really think of how good Jerry was playing that night because I had the I Love You, Alison guy behind me for the most part. So, what's some of your favorite venues, man? You've played around. I mean, you've played all corners of the states, man. What's some that you're like? Either back of the house that's pretty special, or just one just standing on the stage is pretty awesome.
God, there was kind of a strange place in Minneapolis that was really cool. It was a theater. It was called maybe the Majestic Theater. It was just like, it was weird, but it was super cool. I actually watched Three Amigos in the backstage. That was,
oh nice,
the TV it was on. I was like, yeah, this is cool. But it was like, it hadn't changed since probably the 60s. It looked like it was built in the 60s, and it just looked straight out of a time warp. It was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Fox Theater in Oakland is beautiful. Just gorgeous. Really? Like, amazing backstage, and just the stage itself sounds beautiful and looks beautiful. There's so many great places. Yeah.
Yeah, there's this is by no means the Fox in Oakland, but if you get a chance, it's what I love about what I, you know, my professional gig is all the odds and ends things you stumble upon you didn't think about. I was out in Lebanon for a musical series they're starting to do downtown, you know, just a couple hundred people. And they had it right next to this theater. I want to say it's called the Capitol Theater, right downtown Lebanon. This guy went in and bought this building that was just, you know, blank slate, like wall to wall, just bricks, and built out this kind of Art Deco-esque kind of theater with the fixtures. And cool. You walk in the front door and it's got the ticket window, and you walk up a slant, slope concrete to the theater. But the theater that he built out, anybody that has a chance to go out of this theater to either watch a movie or a show, they probably dumped about $3.5 million into this place just to, you know, one of those guys that he's done well with his professional career from mm-hmm. my understanding. And I met him and Bob, he's a great guy. But you know, just wanted to give something back, get the momentum rolling to revive downtown and everything. This theater was just, it floored me. I turned the corner. I was just like, it's one of those ones where you're like, this is in Lebanon. What am I missing here? You know? And, no detail went that they didn't look into, like the chandeliers they bought were from the building was originally built in the 20s. The chandelier.
It was a movie theater at one point?
Yeah, yeah. And it just fell on hard times, and they just pretty much had to gut majority of it. But they went in, and he found light fixtures from Oakland, California, that were built from the 20s that were a period piece of what he was going for. It's got all the smooth, sloping curve lines, even to the stairwell. And you walk up and go to the left, and it opens this door, the double doors into the theater that will seat 350.
Oh, that's so cool.
But instead of doing the normal, you know, theater seats, he did this, the kind of terraced So it's like, you know, terraced up on the top, and it's got like five or six rows, and then terrace, and then it steps down, and it's got five or six rows. Mm-hmm. It's got like four different levels, and plus they built a big stage so they could do either live music or, and they show a lot of movies and stuff there too. But it was interesting because he was telling me that they, if you go up to the second level, that he didn't think about it, and but they noticed an area they had never used and kind of started poking around and realized there was like a whole like 1,500 to 2,000 square foot room with like hardwoods and everything that they just been walled off, you know. And he's like, yeah, we use it for special events and stuff. But just one of those things that, you know, wow. They actually had separate entrance from the alleyway back during segregation to where African Americans would come up the steps and go sit in that area. And that's where most of the balconies in the Southern theaters that have been around a while were all designed for that, because it was to keep to still have commerce, but keep everybody separated. You had whites were on the lower level and African Americans were up in the balcony. These areas was completely separate, different entrances and stuff like that. So, but yeah, that was kind of the history of that once he started digging into it. So, where you live over in Germantown, have you ever done much reading or digging around of what Jefferson used to be? Jefferson Street?
No, I don't know. Actually, don't know much of history about that.
It'll really blow your mind the amount of people that used to play just a few blocks away from where you live. Jefferson Street, like a lot of southern cities of any size, Birmingham, Jackson, Mississippi, different ones. New Orleans was always been pretty liberal, but a lot of them, different southern cities that had during segregation, there was always like one district or one street that was where the African Americans would come into town or lived in town, and it was like shops and stores and entertainment districts and music and a little bit of everything. And Jefferson Street was ours in Nashville. And Jefferson, if you ever see, there's actually a really good book if you find it on Amazon. It's I won't say somebody did the municipal library or whatever, but they went through and took pictures of Nashville throughout the years and then put them right next to where that if you were standing in the same spot modern day.
That's cool.
And all down the Capitol, all the way to Jefferson, Charlotte, all the way back in that area used to be nothing but little shanty kind of lean-to houses. And that's a lot of the it's funny because that's now a lot of the zoning and stuff that bans tiny homes in Nashville is from that era. I mean, from the earlier 1900s. It's not from, you know, the people saying we don't want tiny homes. It's from them wanting to get rid of these shanty homes that were like one or two rooms, dirt floor, so on and so forth. And one of the ways they could do it and force people out of these homes and stuff by saying you couldn't have a home below 500 square feet. So it was just people during that day would just find stuff and build a piece of home together. But that said, is Jefferson used to be the entertainment district for African Americans. I mean, theaters. So then that's where Jimi Hendrix played when he got out of he was stationed at Fort Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
And then after he got out of Fort Campbell, he actually moved back to Nashville because he started playing with a blues. It was a jazz trio. And it was actually a guy that he played in. He was in the military with that played bass, got Jimmy into playing with him. The guy's actually still alive and plays around, as a matter of fact. Lives there in Nashville, I believe. Yeah. Jimmy, when he moved to Nashville, he played for a little over 2 years on Jefferson. He played backup for a lot of different touring acts.
It was probably early 60s or something, right?
Yeah,
or,
yeah. I mean, before he became the Jimi Hendrix that we all know and love today, you know. So he played there for a couple of years, but he played on that, as they used to call it, the Chitlin' Circuit, you know,
right.
All those predominantly all, you know, black artists that played jazz and blues and a little bit of everything, you know, the guys that would tour the Tupelos, where Elvis and all those guys got inspiration from. But Jimmy played rhythm guitar and backup for a handful of those guys. And I believe, I'm going to say it was called, God, I wish I could think of the name of the bar. It's actually, I think it's where the Mason's Lodge is there on Jefferson now. It was originally this bar that had like Monday night talent competitions or jams that everybody played at. But you see the roster of people that played through there on Jefferson and stuff over the years is rather, it's ridiculous. It's pretty nuts when you start digging it up.
Is that kind of cross Rosa Parks there?
Yeah, it used to go all the way over to where you're at now, and you see less of it now, closer to Interstate, but all that dynamic, you see how narrow that street is, and then you go all the way up Jefferson toward Fisk and TSU and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be that whole street. That's why you don't see it's not a major thoroughfare or anything, because it was all theaters and stuff like that, and, you know, shops and buildings and
that's
things,
cool.
And that's why they decided to... Because, you know, after the Civil War, that's what they opened up, you know, Fisk for recently freed slaves and stuff like that, and their family, to go there for education, and that whole corridor and everything down through there. It's kind of a trip. Yeah, I mean, he used to play in a, like I said, I think it was a jazz trio. I think the Musicians Hall of Fame, It's now down in, what is it? The
Municipal Auditorium?
Yeah. I think it before the flood, either they still had it, either it made it through the flood, or they had just got it before he, before the flood, was they had the original stage that he used to play on like 3-4 nights a week, him and his jazz trio.
I didn't even know he lived here. I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. He's always said that his time spent in Nashville is what helped him create his stage presence and showmanship and his work ethic of being a good musician, because he played around so many talented guys here. And most people would take that as like, oh, he played around these old country guys, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, he played with these phenomenal black artists that were just touring all over the place. And it was just, it was a business. Now, being a musician is tough enough in Nashville. What was it like in the 60s? You know, when you're, right. you know, when you're, it's still, we're just now turning the corner, starting to get some momentum for civil rights and all these things. And then, you know, you're an African American artist that came from Seattle, and mm-hmm. you got an experience being in the military and the stuff you dealt with there, and then getting out, and you're from Seattle, then you're dropped right in the middle of, you know, the gateway to the South here in Nashville. Yeah. That the experiences and stuff there had to be a trip, you know. From there is when he moved off to London and recorded and did all that. So it's just, I mean, just the mindset of what it had to take to just wrap your head around, like, oh, this is what I want to do then, was, it's kind of interesting when you think about it.
You know? Well, you know about the room above United Record Pressing, too? There's that apartment up there?
I've heard about it. I've never been in there.
There's an apartment above United Record Pressing where a lot of the Chitlin Circuit artists would stay because they couldn't get hotel rooms.
Oh, okay.
So they were kind of, you know, sympathetic and would let people live up there or stay up there as they were touring through.
Yeah.
Which is really cool, too.
Yeah, did you see that Muscle Shoals documentary?
Yeah, that
was awesome. That same thing. They had the issue there. Rick Hall and all those guys had done in Muscle Shoals, matter of fact. Have you been down there to the studio?
I haven't been there.
Dude, you need to do the drive. It's actually not that bad of a drive. It's maybe a little over an hour.
A friend of mine were talking 2 Saturdays ago just about just going down, just like, because we haven't been yet.
Yeah.
So we need to do that.
It's kind of surreal, especially being in Fame. I mean, Fame, don't get me wrong, has a Walgreens next to it now and everything, but it's very surreal being in there when you just think of, like, you know, like our tour guide, and I'm sure they do with everybody, was, you know, you go in the different studios, and, you know, our tour guide was actually a pretty decent piano player and actually nailed that just a few seconds on one of the guitars in there in the studio. But when you watch that documentary and then you see and hear the names and stuff and you're standing in that room, you're like, well, this is kind of wild, man. You know, to think of, it's kind of like I would just say, it's like Jack Daniels. You know, you go to Lynchburg and like, ah, Jack Daniels in the world. Every bit of it comes out of here. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go to like Fame Studios and you're like, you know.
So much good music came out of there.
Dude, it's like that original. That my favorite is the one is everybody not knowing where all those sounds came from. And it goes back to the flip of opinion what everybody had was, you know, it's like that opening lick to Down on Main Street with Bob Seger. You know, it's like, oh, Detroit guy, dirty. You're like, no, that was some really white dudes from down in Alabama that came up with that. yeah. You know, and just a lot, because he did, you know, all the songs you know from him, or majority of them were done down in Alabama.
Did he record most of them there?
Yeah, and Rod Stewart, a lot of his stuff. And, you know, the Stones did Wild Horses down there. And just so much stuff like
Paul
that.
Paul Simon, I think, did some stuff there.
Yeah. I mean, especially that documentary, once you watch the Muscle Shoals, if y'all haven't ever watched it, phenomenal documentary. Yeah, I mean,
so good.
Don't get me wrong, I think it could have had about 40 minutes cut out of it from Rick talking about himself, because it seems Rick likes to talk about himself. But I think they did a good job capturing the vibe of that part of the country and that whole area, which I'm not sure if you ever spent very much time in Mississippi and Alabama, but
not a ton. I've been through it a bunch of times, but not a lot.
Yeah, if you get a chance to take a road trip, man, take the Natchez Trace down and through Mississippi, or, you know, down to Natchez, Mississippi, or go to New Orleans or whatever, man. And that studio at Florence and Muscle Shoals is definitely worth stopping at, you know. And Billy Reid actually has his annual symposium that's pretty cool.
Right.
Yeah, if you ever get a chance to catch that one, because especially it's really good to go get a lot of really cheap clothes, because they take all the seconds from Billy Reid or stuff that didn't sell or prototypes, and they have a big warehouse sale of them. So, you know, I'm never going to be able to spend $300 on a pair of Billy Reid cargo shorts, but I can spend $25. I'm like, oh, it actually just make it shoppable while you're down there. They have some really cool stuff, man.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, I've been down there. I went down there last year. I'd like to go back this year. It's a really cool event that he does, because it's, if you've never been down to it, man, it's really cool, because it just has different food and beverage, just like food and beverage. And then band we were talking about earlier, Wild Cub, played down there, and Apache Relay played, opening up for them too, which I think those guys are still out playing, aren't they? Apache Relay?
Yep. Yeah. They were opening for Wild Feathers last year.
Oh, wow.
On their tour. I think, you know, Steelism, Those guys have played
that
Billy Reid thing too, I think.
Yeah, that theater down there is kind of stuck in time too, if you ever get a chance to go check it out down there, where they have the shows right in the middle of downtown.
What's that place called? I've heard about it.
I can't remember.
Farms Theater or something?
Yeah, it may be. It's right there, man. But that's really cool. But Muscle Shoals is in Florence, all that, it's really unique. That whole Florence downtown area and everything is really wild. Of just, I don't know, man. I guess it's one of those things that's like the old Southern thing. Like, I grew up in Arkansas, and we just didn't have that much stuff around. But when you start getting those dirtier, grittier parts of the South, it's kind of an interesting dynamic, you know?
Ever been to Sun in Memphis? Sun Studio?
Never have, man. Same thing. I've driven by it quite a few times, so.
Man, it's hard to not get a little misty-eyed in there, because you feel all the history.
Yeah.
And it's a tiny little room, this little, like, tile floor.
Yeah,
it's so small. And you're like, really? Elvis made rock and roll in here, and Johnny Cash and all that stuff, and Jerry Lewis, and it's pretty intense. It's cool, man.
The ripples, just that pedal, that one pebble there with the ripples it sent.
Oh yeah,
to going forward. Same way. Have you ever been to Elvis's house in Tupelo?
Not that's the tiny little one he was born in.
Yeah,
no, I've never been there.
Well, let's be honest, Graceland really ain't that big.
It really isn't. Honestly, I tell people it's really. Quite a humble place for someone of Elvis' stature.
Yeah, I think his airplane across the street has more square footage in it than Graceland
does. It's just like a house like a grandma could live in, you know?
Yeah. It's funny because I remember standing in the back of Graceland that one time I went there with my buddy Mike. And one thing I remember most is I got Dippin' Dots out of a vending machine after we left. And and looking across the fence and there being just like a broken down swing set. You know, just like it's some house right the street, one street over. And I'm like, this is just—it's just a neighborhood, dude. You know, it's like nobody's like, oh yeah, Graceland's right there. Oh yeah, 1.2 million people turn through that driveway every year, but it's just like it's just another house on the street.
I love Graceland. I go whenever I'm in Memphis.
Yeah, I've mentioned this too. You know that is. You ever read up much on his manager, Colonel Tom Parker?
Just read a great book by Peter Guralnik.
Really?
Who I forgot what the name of the book was, but he wrote two volumes. One was Last Train to Last Train to Memphis. Yeah, and the other one was Careless Love. It was called. Great.
Really?
Super detailed account of like their relationship.
Really?
And like Elvis
so it's a
from like the army.
About Elvis and the Colonels?
Well, Last Train to Memphis kind of catalogs Elvis's rise.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Guralnik's an amazing writer. So like it's from his birth to 1956 or so.
Wow.
And then this takes off from when he gets out of the army. So from the army till his death.
Wow.
And it's incredible.
That it so is, good. Man. What else has that author written?
Peter Guralnik, he wrote a book on the band, I believe.
Okay.
Van Morrison, just all sorts of The Doors. He's written tons of Sam Cooke.
Okay, great.
I think he wrote some Sweet Soul Music.
Yeah.
I believe he wrote that.
How did he portray Elvis in the Colonel's relationship? Because it's always been back and forth, everybody, depending on what side they want to take about the whole dynamic.
He was pretty good about being an outsider about it and looking in, and it seemed like it was symbiotic. They needed each other.
Yeah.
Elvis, like you were talking about, there's the guys who are really talented, but I mean, can't do the business. And then there's the guys who are great at business who aren't as talented. And I think those guys needed to find each other to make that what happened happen. He saw I could turn this guy into a giant star. Mm-hmm. Elvis is so humble. He was kind of a humble guy. I don't think he knew that he could do that.
Yeah.
Until the Colonel came along and was like, I'm going to turn you into a star.
Yeah.
And then he just did whatever he said. Whatever the Colonel said, he did. I'll make these terrible movies. Fine.
Colonel was a hustler, man.
He was a hustler.
He was, man. I mean, coming from a carny background.
Oh, yeah.
And everything.
Smart guy.
Yeah.
Smart guy.
Very business savvy of just a hustling of like knowing the game. Knowing the midway of life, as some might say. Of knowing like, all right, which one are you? Are you the guy that's running the booth? Or are you the guy walking down the midway? And the Colonel was one of those people, from what I'm understanding, that could pick that out, that knew. Man, it supports the mentality a lot. In my one quote I read from Elvis, when they said, "Do you know the Colonel is like 50% of your income? The Colonel, everything you make, the Colonel gets it." And Elvis's response was, "Well, he works really hard. I think it's worth it."
Yeah,
you know, and I'm like
50-50 deal.
Yeah, and that sounds really bad to a lot of people, but 50% of playing around Memphis, or you know, having 75% of just playing around Memphis. Isn't anything in comparison to 50% of being Elvis, you know?
Exactly.
And it's just like,
right.
Would he have ever had the guy that pushed him? Would he ever had the guy that kept that train rolling? I mean, and it's just the conveyor belt of what Elvis Inc. was.
Yeah.
Between all the hangers on and everything else and the movies. But the movies, you know, you look at it too, it's like, look, man, if you got a formula, Hollywood still does it today. If you're going to gross, you know, then it was $25 million or whatever it was per movie. Dude, it's a set format. Why? No business person would ever change that.
Yeah.
No one. I mean, even as many people said, well, Elvis was a good actor. He could have done bigger things. You don't know. You don't know.
Right.
I mean, yeah, he was a good actor, but if they had a format that worked, I don't know.
Plus,
yeah.
this is the thing about Elvis, too. A lot of people think of Elvis as like, oh, fat Elvis, and he was kind of a whatever. I feel like it gets a bad rap sometimes, but he was the first rock star.
Yeah.
I mean, he had Sinatra,
yeah,
of course, before him, but Elvis was the first guy who did rock and roll and kind of aged out of rock and roll. Like,
yeah.
He's like, okay, I'm 35 now. Can I still do this?
Yeah.
Like, now it's like, you know, Mick Jagger and those guys between the Beatles and the Stones, and those guys are still doing it, the Dead. You know you can play rock and roll into your old age. But when you were in the 50s and 60s, Elvis thought, well, I'm just going to do this for like 2 or 3 years, and I'm going to be broke again.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the Colonel's like, well, let's make you a movie star so you have some income coming in. So, I mean, it makes sense to me that he would be like, okay, I'll just do whatever you say. You seem to be smarter than me.
Yeah.
Once this rock and roll stuff goes away, I need money somehow.
Yeah. What about Vegas money? Would anybody really have taken up a residency if Elvis hadn't planted that flag? Would anybody ever thought of like, hey,
right.
I mean, you got the Britney Spears of today. I mean, look what Garth did. Look at all these people.
It's kind of what part of your trajectory now, if your career kind of goes like a Celine Dion, Garth,
you
go to Vegas. Elvis was kind of the first guy besides Sinatra and those dudes, of course, to do that in rock and roll. And now you can do it in country, and now you can do it in pop.
Yeah.
So I cut the guy a lot of slack.
Yeah, I do too, man. And my argument's always been this, because I overheard some family members at a get-together talking about, like, you know, Elvis, he died so young. What did he die in his 40s?
42.
Yeah, 42.
Yeah.
Elvis died at 42. And my argument's always been this. You got to be really honest with yourself and ask yourself, if you had two choices, to be 80 years on this planet as you or 42 years on this planet as Elvis, those 42 Elvis years...
They're jam-packed.
You never had to wait in line for groceries. You never had to worry about the DMV.
You would get the reserve table at Arnold's.
You would. You get the whole left row of table.
The governor would give you his table.
Elvis, you know, up until like 2 days before, he had the Liberty Land rented out where they just ride the roller coaster all night long.
Mm-hmm.
How cool would that be? He's never had to wait in line for a roller coaster.
Dude, he flew Lisa Marie once from Memphis to someplace cold. Just because she'd never seen snow before, like on his jet. It's like, you know, let's go see some snow for 2 hours and flew back.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
What about that picture of him just stoned out of his gourd with Nixon? He woke up at like 2 a.m. That picture was taken after midnight. That picture wasn't taken in the afternoon.
Oh, they're shaking hands?
Yeah. Elvis, he was big into law enforcement, right, and he wanted a badge, and he didn't have... You know, some specific special badge that somebody called, and, you know, the Nixon administration, you know, wanted to be hip with the kids, so they accepted Elvis. You know, like Nixon, that's a difference in politician then. There's no way anybody would look at him and said, like, this guy is high as hell, you know? And they're like, cool, great photo op, you know?
Right.
You know, it was a big deal when Carter allowed, Willie to come into the White House and everything. And then Elvis shows up just all out of his skull and his meds and everything, you know? Which whoever the doctor was, that guy, you know, to be able to keep it between the lines back there, that's a balance, man.
Seriously.
You know? You get so many musicians, including Hendrix and all these guys, that couldn't do it. And in Keith Richards' book, he makes a good point about that, about his philosophy on drugs and how they kept from anybody dying, you know, him specifically or anybody else, you know, between the amount of drugs they were doing and everything, about how... particular, he had this old gangster tell him about like how particular that they needed to be about how much they were using, because his philosophy is like, you know, you can use cocaine, you know, to a certain point, it'll, you know, you'll get high, but you're not gonna get higher. And the guy had explained to him about heroin too, is like, you're gonna get high, but using more isn't gonna get you higher of what you're doing.
He'll kill you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he had to be very particular early on, because he had Keith had to step up and be the guy that delegated how much drugs everybody got at one point in time.
Keith regulated it?
Yeah, really? Because apparently, I think that's what happened to, what's his name? Is it Sid Vicious, the punk guy? Yeah. Was that the problem with a lot of people, they overdose, especially on heroin, and what happened with him is he got arrested and was off of it for a day or so while he was arrested, and came right back out of jail and tried to jump right back in to what he was using. And your body already starts to to scale back of what your tolerance is at that point. So if you go right back to where you were, that's what a lot of people have overdose problems and stuff. And Keith had known that, and he said that was one of the reasons why he was always very particular about the way he cut it and everything with the minor, when they were really hardcore into the heroin, when they were in the exile days, when they were literally just holed up in a house, so on and so forth. But a lot of demons in there, man.
Yeah.
That whole book is a whole lot of demons about it. But Elvis's thing, that's why I always see somebody now eating either Jello or like a grapefruit or a citrus. I'm like, what, are you on the Elvis diet? You know, because Elvis, before he go on tour, that's what he was just eating. He was eating nothing but pain pills or whatever he was on. And then, you know, eating like his chef or his cook would say that he would, you know, he'd just like have big bowls of Jello or you know, like grapefruit or something like that. That was his getting into tour shape or whatever. So, but, it was interesting to me how the Colonel never, Elvis never toured in South America or overseas.
Well, there's a theory in the book that, well, the Colonel was, he was from Denmark or something, I think.
I think
he was
there in Netherlands, one of the two.
Yeah, he might have been an immigrant in here illegally.
Yeah.
So he didn't want to get a passport and go overseas with Elvis because he thought, you know, they'd find out about it. That's a theory.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's also the cost of doing, you know, touring Europe too, so I think he felt that there's a lot of different theories about why he didn't tour. But Elvis, I mean, Elvis never really toured properly in Europe. Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
he never went over there. It's just crazy.
But then again, I you know, you hear that about him not touring Europe, but then again, you hear how crappily Queen was treated when they toured the States. You know, when they came over here, just because, you know, it was the speculation of Freddie Mercury's sexuality and his flamboyant ways of being on stage and stuff, so much that it turned him off to come to the States. You know,
is
it's
that
like,
right?
Yeah, it's really huge. But there was, and then the earlier when their career, when they first toured the States, at this point, they were massive in Europe and in England. And, you know, they already had a massive amount of hits, and they had hits and stuff over here too. But they really didn't get good reviews from the stage show and stuff, and that kind of over the top antics, you know, that he, you know, he was just used to being Freddie Mercury, man. It just really, I think, from what a couple of accounts I read, it just really kind of turned him off the reception he got from audiences and stuff once he played over here. But, man, if you go back through any of those Queen, you watch any of those performances of like in Wembley or any of those, dude?
I haven't seen them in a while. I've seen clips.
Of stuff. Well, if you just ever go back to any of them and catch any of them, it's just like those days of like just like today, Stones played the, you know, the Titan Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, U2 play stadiums, Taylor Swift play stadium, but to be able to have a whole stadium in the palm of your hand, those days are gone, man. Nobody has that anymore.
Freddie Mercury had that.
Yeah.
He had that thing.
Yeah. With the exception of that, and then, you know, your other project, you know, the Electric Western y'all do at the 5 Spot and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, between, you know, you see what DJs and stuff now, and to be able to have that vibe, be able to control that vibe and mentality and to have people like that, that's gonna be something that's pretty ridiculous, man. You know,
cool.
You guys, you know, to do it on a, you know, weekly, you know, monthly basis, or, you know, I know you're there, your residency at the 5 Spot, but man, you're playing out at, you're doing Atlanta and a few other places too, aren't you?
Yeah, we do Atlanta once a month. Actually just did a 3-year anniversary in Atlanta.
How's the reception?
Awesome.
Stuff down there,
it's great.
Yeah,
it's killer. Been super fun. It's like Nashville. It's as intense. Actually, it's kind of crazier these days.
Really?
Yeah.
What size is the venue in comparison to 5 Spot?
We can get about 525 people in there.
That's a lot of people, dude.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like much, but when you get 500 people in one spot and you're
all dancing, and
yeah, you're sweating. In charge of the mood and the vibe and everything going off without a hitch or anything.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty big deal, man.
That's awesome.
Yeah. What was the mentality trying to start in that? I mean, I'm a big fan of older. I mean, a lot of older music, especially a lot of older country, a lot of older folk, a lot of that stuff that you just start to discover. I mean, where was the mindset of, you know, when you and Jacob got together and all that, of like, dude, I think we can make a go at this.
Well, that's kind of actually, that's my favorite music of all time. Like soul, old soul music, 50s rock and roll. I grew up on that stuff. So that's kind of like my first influence for music ever. And when I go home, I listen to that music. Like, it's what I put on to relax, you know? So it's just something I love. And then we started doing that and realized there wasn't anything like that happening in Nashville. And people just started coming and dancing. And then we tell their friends to come. And it just turned into this, it snowballed to this very organic thing. We had no idea it was going to be like this. But luckily it has. And it's been almost 7 years.
Yeah.
Just every Monday night, the 5 Spot.
Of all those artists that, I mean, you've dug through and dug through and dug through, what's the one that every time, you know, there are just a handful of them, or, you know, or just specific tracks, or artists and tracks, or song, excuse me, artists and songs, that you're just like, damn, man. That, I mean, everything, every note on this song is exactly where it should be, that just hits that spot where you're like, God, everything. There's not a fault on this. You know,
David Ruffin, singer, lead singer of the Temptations.
Really,
my favorite singer, I think, probably of all time.
So has he always been the lead singer of the Temptations?
Well, no. There was three. He was the lead singer on kind of the big hits of the early 60s. Okay. Ain't Too Proud to Beg, My Girl, that stuff. He was the first guy. Then there was some, you know, we talked about earlier, band dynamic. There was some friction there with those guys, and he left the band or got fired or whatever and had a solo career. Never was as big as the Temptations, but then two other guys came in later. And then David Ruffin had a rough time of it after Temptations. He kind of got into crack and stuff and died fairly young, too.
Mm.
But just his vocals are untouchable. Just the way he hits the high notes, the way he hits the low notes, like the passion in his voice. It's incredible.
What do you think that is? I mean, when you go from like him, someone like him that is, you know, the lead, you know, the Temptations and has hit those notes and that's his voice, it's recognizable. What happened? What's the point of when it broke off? There wasn't one or two people that just came. I mean, do you think he just got to a point where there were so many hangers on and yes man at that point,
or for him to leave the band or get kicked out?
Well, how can you not take your continuation of your success of where that came from, of his voice? The talent is still there.
Right.
Yeah, you don't have three or four guys behind you to help collaborate on songwriting and things like that.
Yeah,
but
that's huge.
You know,
I think it was kind of that. I think that there's the politics of that too. It's like, first of all, I think his ego got a little bit out of check.
So yeah.
That, you know, he was kind of hard to work with.
Yeah.
So then you don't get the best songs anymore.
Yeah.
Right? And the Temptations are getting the better songs than you're getting from the songwriters, you know.
Yeah.
So he didn't make great albums after that. He didn't have great singles. So that was, I think that's just, it's still true today.
Yeah.
In Nashville, if you have a country artist, right, and they're not really writing their own songs, and then, you know, you got to have really good songs to be on the charts.
Yeah.
And if you don't get those songs, you don't get on the charts anymore.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing as it was back then.
Yeah, that's what's been the interesting dynamic, and it seems like it's been every year and a half to 2 years, and over the last, you know, 10 years or maybe a little less in Nashville, for me to be able to see like those people the people that really resonate with a little bit unorthodox platform. First one that really stood out to me was when Jamie Johnson hit the scene.
Oh yeah,
with the Lonesome Song, and that whole album just ripped your soul out. That first one, the solo album he did after songwriting with all these other guys. And then next was when Jason Isbell finally got clean, you know, with his second album, you know, with the second album of being solo. And then recently, we were talking about earlier, Sturgill Simpson stuff too. And, you know,
those guys are standouts for sure.
Oh, it's just, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, especially like that Turtles All the Way Down song,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be able to point that out to somebody, and like the format of that song is not a traditional format of a song that somebody would try to program, and neither is that that whole album. But it's just interesting how people's taken different formats. I mean, even with the dynamic of like a label behind the scenes, as well as different format of band touring, philosophy of songs and all that. You know, it's very interesting for especially Isbell to come out from underneath that Drive-By Truckers thing, mm-hmm. you know. And that's my biggest issue I've had with Jamie Johnson is the fact that he wrote Honky Tonk Badonkadonk. But at the end of the day, I'm going to guess that's paid for a lot of light bills, man.
That's probably allowed him to make the records he's wanted to make.
Exactly.
You know,
it's one of the things that, you know, even just like a B-side, you know, on a song never got played on a George Strait album. It's like, that's still a pretty good place to be, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I just saw that Zac Brown Band covered Dress Blues,
mm-hmm.
Jason Isbell's, on his latest record, which is awesome.
Yeah.
It's going to expose Jason to a whole new crowd of people who don't.
Have you know listened to that album, the Zac Brown album?
I have.
It's I love it.
Over the place, man.
I love it, dude.
It's cool. Like, there's there's like a Frank Sinatra jam, sort of. Like,
oh,
a,
yeah, you know, the big like band with Sarah Bareilles. Yeah.
And then it goes into like this heavy thing with Chris Cornell.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's awesome.
Yeah. I was, last week, I was talking to one of the members of the band, and you know, we're sitting there talking about that album. I'm like, man, a lot of people don't know this about me, but one of my favorite things in life to do outside of, you know, helping grow a business and, you know, building great relationships with people is really just messing with people. And I'm like, when I listen to this whole album, it made me happy that you guys, you know, were forward thinking enough to just do what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And to go in a studio and do it in every one of those songs, they nail it.
Yeah.
I mean, nail it. There's a couple songs on there that just, I was listening to them, I was like, damn, man. I mean, especially the Chris Cornell one, you're like, this has got like a 90s. Once you get to like the fifth track, you're like, all right, I got it now. Because that first song on the album is just, it's kind of like a top 40 pop song.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. It's kind of like it's got like a disco beat almost.
Yeah. They reminded me a lot of Avicii. You know,
I know who that is. I haven't.
It's heard the guy that had, the DJ that does he's produced for everybody, but he does that song "Wake Me Up." Wake me up when it's not over. And there's somebody like just covered it here recently too. So yeah, that one I'll play just a preview. You'll know what I'm talking about. But yeah, that one, because I was talking to a buddy, and I was like, dude, that album that y'all did with such a. He's like, yeah, I know, man, we loved it. He goes, it was the cool part of it. I was sitting in the room and really break down those things that we really wanted to do with an album. And then it all fits. It's all over the place. But even seeing them play those songs live, you're like, oh, that's such a great song, man. Yeah. This song.
This is Avicii?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
He made such a good bit of money from just his solo of just being a DJ that when he made this album, pretty much he covered... he kind of like did what Daft Punk did. He just went and said, what do we want to do with this one? It's a couple songs that like Nile Rodgers co-wrote on. And this is my favorite one of all of them to reach out to this one. You're this one. Let's get to download here. But this is one that I liked whenever he started reaching out and he's like, this is the voice I want to fit this song.
Hey, brother, there's an endless road to rediscover.
You can't pick it up. Speaking of soundtracks, probably the most successful soundtrack song.
The voice on here?
Yeah.
Who's that?
It's Dan Tominski.
Dan Tominski?
Yeah.
Who's that?
You probably recognize it. I played the other song that you definitely would recognize him from most. Let's see. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, this song you definitely recognize him from. This one right here. This one right here. This song you've definitely heard it from. Make sure, hold on, we got the lyrics here. So, nope, not it. Hold on, let me find it here. Here we go. This one right here. It's huge off the soundtrack, so I gotta get past the commercials. See what they're trying to sell me here. No, I can't tell what they're trying to sell me. This isn't one of the commercials I even get to fast forward to, which I was told the other day that you don't have to pay for the commercial as an advertiser unless they watch the whole commercial. Which is a brilliant concept. That's why you see those first 5-6 seconds that everybody puts on them. This, let's see, where are we at? See when this song starts up. It's a quick one.
I am a man of constant sorrow. Oh, of course.
Yep, same guy.
Ah. Well, that's cool.
Yeah, that was pretty
so
good.
So he got people like that to sing on his record?
Yeah, he got Dan. Like, yeah, he got Dan.
Daft Punk did.
Yeah, he got Dan Tominski to sing on the Avicii did. So if you listen to the whole album, it's kind of like that, Daft Punk, they just got, so many.
Paul Williams, yeah, George Moroder.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the lineup of people he got to play with him on that album, because he'd made so much, as an artist, he had made so much money touring as a DJ. I mean, you sit down with an album and he's like, oh, I got, I've got $10 million to do this album with.
Kind of like Mark Ronson just did.
Yeah.
That record with Bruno Mars on it, Stevie Wonder.
Yeah. And
dudes from Tame Impala.
Yeah. Well, David Guetta did it. David Guetta did it. He did it about 4 or 5 years ago, too, where he had like 5 number one pop hits from 5 different people. It's just like he doesn't have to. That was interesting from a production standpoint of view to just do like, hey, I want to do this. And then on the behind the scenes, this is everything else I want to do with, with the whole thought process of like, hey, my name's going to be on this instead of I'm just going to produce it for Nicki Minaj or whoever. Yeah. Yeah, they're on it, but we're both on it. It's a co-billing. Yeah, and I thought awesome. That was pretty. They can never do it live unless it's an award show or something because he's got everybody else out there. But I thought that was pretty cool of the one they did. But yeah, I was really impressed by the Zach Brown and that one. And let's see if I can pull up this first one that, like I said, that reminded me. Yeah, Beautiful Drug is the first one that it reminded me of that Avicii Wake Me Up on the beginning part of it that I really liked a lot. That is like that top 40, kind of vibe to it.
Well, I thought the whole album was going to sound like that when I heard it. I'm like, really? They made a pop record, huh?
Yeah.
And then I listened to the rest of it. I'm like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
Really diverse.
Because it starts out with just like a, but
it's almost like the tuned vocal. Too.
Yeah.
Lipstick and heels, pull me in, give me hooks like a junkie. Got me feeling so high. You're such a beautiful joke. Can't get enough.
See, yeah, I love that dude. Yeah. I was at, we went and saw their show when they were here in town, man. And they just crushed that song.
I've never seen them live. I want to see them live, though.
Oh, God, man. I mean,
badass musicians.
Everybody in the band is just, I mean, dead on, man. But just the show of hearing them play a lot of the new album. And I loved it because you got a lot of the, you know, the Tall Wallet guys and the sparkly, you know, Affliction shirts, hardcore middle of the road country fans and stuff there that, you know, Zach Brown is, I mean, the band has always been great. But a lot of these songs are, dude, they're not, you know, you're not going to hear any of those songs on country radio. Maybe one or two, but nothing like the previous albums and stuff like that, you know, that had like five or six, you know, really good songs.
There's one song that's on country radio right now with As She's Walking Away. Not that one. What's the name of the track? They're playing it now, but it's like classic Zach Brown, and the rest of them, they can do whatever the hell they want at this point.
Oh, right? Yeah.
It's like they've earned it.
Yeah, this is the one I like. This tune, Bittersweet, was really good. It's one I liked. This is one of those, I think it's like the ninth track. Is this a classical? That's why I loved it. The different pace of this whole album was just so awesome. I just love that just simplistic lead in, man.
Yeah. Can't
tell where the sky begins and the water. And the effects on his voice, too.
Yeah. Eric Church has a song on his latest record, too, I heard. It's got this really heavy John Lennon slapback delay on the vocal.
Yeah.
That's like a single. I'm like, wow, this is cool production for a mainstream single.
Yeah, it's...
I like that things are getting a little bit experimental at times. People are not afraid to do stuff.
Yeah. Which one was that?
Is it the Wrecking Ball song, maybe?
Yeah, it is Wrecking Ball. Let's see. Which one? Let's see. Yeah, this one right here. This one, I've listened to the hell out of Eric Church here recently. I don't, it's not much top 40 country, but his last three albums, including this one, is phenomenal.
This Outsiders?
Yeah. That whole album is phenomenal, man. Man Is Gonna Die Young is probably my favorite track. It's on there. It's really good.
Yeah, this is the jam.
Yeah, this is Wrecking Ball. His vocals kick in. Yeah, that's that effect, cool. Too. It sounds really good. But I love this whole album. I've been gone. Been gone too long, singing my songs on a room, another town, one more show, and I'm coming home. Don't give a damn what these keys I hold. I'm on a knock down that front door and wanna find out what that house is made of. Been too many nights since it's felt us make love. Wanna rock some sheetrock, knock some pictures off the wall. Love you, baby, like a wrecking ball. You, look at you, send me one more shot. Sitting on the bathroom sink, damn you, ready to turn me on. I'm painting your toenails paint, easy baby for you to say. But if I can make it just one more day, that old house is gonna be shaking. I hope those bricks and boards can take it. But I won't be surprised if the whole damn place just falls. Take it right there, baby. Rock it, baby, like a wrecking ball. Awesome. That was just led into Wrecking Ball. That's off Eric Church's newest album, Outsiders, here with Reno Bo. We're just chatting up the tunes, man. It's a good thing about having everything at your fingertips. I don't know what it was like when people really didn't have access to music and stuff. You know, I mean, I just wonder how many bar fights and parking lot stabbings that Google has saved people whenever they get in a heated argument about, you know, who was the first baseman in the World Series in 62 or something, you know,
right?
After all those same ones, you know.
Here you go, pal. Just Google it.
Yeah, yeah, dude. You know, it's one of those ones that the worst is whenever you're like, all right, nobody could Google it. We just got to sit here and talk this out, you know, like, ah, I was so wrong, you know.
I remember my mom, like, had a call when I was younger. There was an argument with my dad or something. She had to call my uncle. I'm like, no, the guy who did this on this record, or whatever it was. She could call my uncle. I'm like, who played on the single from 1961, whatever it was.
Yeah.
That was Google back then.
Yeah, the uncle. That's that uncle. My mother is one of 11 kids, and I have all of her brothers are all, I mean, and the sisters too. To take that back, everybody very bright, well read people. I mean, maybe one of her siblings has ever got a college degree or anything, but my uncle David, that's how he got into keeping bees. He's a truck driver, drove a feed truck his whole life in Arkansas. And one day, some guy just called up that uncle and just goes, hey, David, we got all these bees around our air conditioning unit, and we don't know how to get rid of them. And he's just, you know, the old guy that just does know stuff. Yeah, just because he's been around. You know, he's not like a know-it-all. He just read or talked to people, and, you know, just through the years. And he's like, all right, I'll be right down. Went down and, you know, went down and got the queen and put her in a little like film capsule that was vented, you know, that film used to come in, and then put that inside of a box, and then just took like a few handfuls of the bees and threw them all in this box, put them in the bed of his truck, and drove up and already had a hive there, and clipped the tip of the queen's wings and put her in the hive. And that was 3 years ago. He's up to like 25 hives of bees now.
Wow.
And then it all started with just because somebody's like, do you know how to get rid of bees? You know, and all the bees followed, you know. It's like they all the next day, all the other bees showed up at it wherever his hive and stuff was. And now he's got like, you know, 25 hives spread over like three different pieces of property from that old guy.
That's
that
awesome.
Just called from that point.
How
so
cool is that? Just going with the flow. I love that.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, sweet, dude. Then we'll wrap up. I'm going to play title track out of here, man. I really enjoyed that song a lot.
Thanks, man.
That's a really, really good song. Not saying, like I said, not saying the other ones aren't, but I enjoyed that one, and you know, a few other of them that are really, really well. You really stood out. So everybody can reach you at Reno Bo on Twitter, Instagram, mm-hmm. and
RenoBo.com.
Yeah, and you got your own name. I just had to buy mine for a grand.
Yeah, you had to buy a grand. That's too bad.
I yeah,
that's
no,
expensive,
no.
But well, could have been
not
10
since,
G's.
Yeah, not since the YouTube biographer and the guy that does all their stuff has the same name spelled the same way. Figured that I considered that cheap.
Yeah,
that, I mean, it was. I looked around for a while. For a while, it wasn't available, and finally, I was able to get it. So I haven't built it out or anything yet, but it's nice to have it. So
yeah, that's awesome.
But yeah, and you're on iTunes, right? And we get that one on iTunes.
Mm-hmm. iTunes, Spotify, the works.
Yeah, definitely everybody hop on and check it out, man. Really good album. I'm going to play out with Lessons from a Shooting Star. Let me make sure I can get this one. There we go. I mean, ones I've been potting up. See if I can help with this one. So, yeah, thanks again, Reno. I appreciate
you
coming and sitting in
me.
With us. Yeah, for sure, brother. Yeah, man. Y'all go check out the album and enjoy the rest of your Sunday.